Hello, everybody. This is Ali Safavi, your host for InsurTech Unscripted. I'm here today. I'm super excited to have Charles Birnbaum. He's a partner at Bessemer Venture Partners. He's a guy that I think I first ran into him when I was at Plug and Play many years ago. It sounds like many years ago. InsurTech, as a whole, hasn't been like that long, but it also feels like it's been compared to like how much the community has grown a while ago. And he's been looking at insurance for a very long time. He's been talking to a lot of startups for many times, but he's very picky about which ones to invest in. So he's one of those that I always enjoy talking to because he has very specific, strong thesis as someone who's very educated in the space, but at the same time, very picky about what to invest in and whatnot. So Charles, great to have you on.
Thanks, Ali. We've been talking for a long time because we're both a lot older than we look, hopefully.
So Charles, maybe we could kick it off with like you telling us a little bit more about your background. You're going to specific focus on insurance, how long you've been looking at the space and, you know, just kind of setting the stage of where your expertise comes from.
Sure. Been with Bessemer a little over 10 years now. Spent the first part of my career in technology, investment banking and capital markets. And then coming out of business school, I was one of the first employees at Foursquare, a startup here in New York, where I wore a lot of different hats, employee 10 all the way to a lot of the hype cycle of a typical consumer company before becoming an investor. And ever since I joined Bessemer, we had a longstanding financial services practice. And I kind of identified that we hadn't done anything really in insurance. And it's such a large swath of GDP in both developed and less developed markets. And it just seemed like a huge opportunity for us. So I've been focused on the space for a full decade myself.
Very cool. And that basically means you started getting involved with insurance before InsurTech became super hyped.
Yeah, a little bit. It kind of happened while I was, we call it road mapping here at Bessemer, which is our just thesis-driven approach to going deep in a space before writing any check. And while I was doing that in insurance, that's when kind of this whole InsurTech wave of the past decade was just getting going. This is when a lot of great companies that have built really large businesses were seeded. It takes time to make an impact in the insurance industry. I'm sure something we'll talk about today. But some of the ones that went shortcut and direct to consumer and direct to business were just getting off the ground. And some of the software companies that I actually think are just turning the corner on impacting the industry, via the wave of bringing insurance finally into the cloud is probably one of the last industries to enter the cloud era. That started about 8 or 9 years ago as well. So it's been interesting to watch how it's unfolded. And as you know better than anybody, insurance is not one thing, right? Direct to consumer P&C is very different than life insurance, very different than commercial insurance, very different than all of the software that's sold to each element of the stack. And there's lots to do and lots to talk about.
Yeah, makes sense. So Charles, I usually like to kick off the discussion with a very easy question, which is, what is the most contrarian point of view that you have that you feel like it's kind of unique compared to the majority?
My most contrarian point of view right now is probably that I think it's probably among the most exciting industries to build software businesses in for the next decade. As I said earlier, I think the last wave of startups was a little bit distracted by the direct-to-consumer and direct-to-business opportunities. And companies like Lemonade and Hippo and Root, CoverWallet, which sold to Aon, you know, there's been many great successes, you know, depending on your entry point. However, I feel like this is an industry that's still running largely on either very legacy software, you know, companies that have really tried to pretend like cloud businesses. I'm not going to name names of specific public companies, but there are definitely ones out there that might consider them cloud businesses that I think are still very ripe for disruption, but it's not something that's going to happen in 3 or 4 years in insurance. And I think some of the companies that started several years ago are really starting to turn the corner on making an impact and disrupting the industry. And I think the industry is just getting ready to actually adopt a lot of interesting technologies. And the recent breakthroughs in generative AI could be an interesting wedge for new companies to be created, which we'll talk about as well.
Yeah, there's a lot to unfold there. I think I'd like to start with what you said, which is insurance is still very interesting. Let's break it down like this. What were the reasons that you thought insurance is interesting a few years ago? Because like when I speak to investors, it just drives me crazy when I'm like, insurance was interesting a few years ago, in my opinion, at least, and I'd love to get your thoughts, which is a big industry, a lot of information, is old, all that kind of stuff. And then we have a few use cases of like startups that are mainly B2C that, you know, obviously were successful to some extent, but then the public market wasn't too nice to them for whatever reason. And we could talk about like the issues with the business model, and I have a lot of opinions about that. But to say that insurtech is not good where the fundamentals are still there, to me, it makes no sense. So let me ask you this, like, how do you see that evolution happen? Like, how do we go from insurance is hot, all these opportunities, to people feeling like insurance is not hot? Like, it makes no sense.
I think it's about speed. And often I think this happens across a lot of elements of financial services, not just insurance. And I lead our financial services practice, so I don't just focus on insurance. I think it's similar in banking, wealth management, you know, other industries where sometimes the things that get out of the gate really hot and grow really, really quickly, giving out some sort of free lunch, as we like to say, and nothing's free in financial services. I mean, there's a risk spectrum. Someone is taking the risk. Someone is finding the customer, and there's so many different steps in between. And I think in insurance, people got a little bit distracted by the shortcut to growth. And there's a lot of elements in insurance that are similar to a lending model, right? If you offer easier access to capital and lower rates, you're going to grow more quickly than a capital provider that is charging a higher rate and more restrictive on who they lend to. Giving out an insurance policy at a lower premium with higher risk of loss is the exact same paradigm. And we, you know, again, not to name specific company names, but a lot of companies grew really quickly in a zero interest rate environment. By the way, kudos to them for taking really low cost venture capital, building brands, promising cross-sell and better economics in the future, and creating a lot of generational wealth for a lot of people. But ultimately, those business models always were going to have to cross the chasm of really good ratios, which is what insurance is all about. Combined ratios, loss ratios, expense ratios, all the stuff that those of us that go deep nerd out about, and you can find software companies that are just attacking one element of one of those ratios and have potential to generate $400 million of ARR a year. That's why I say it's a lot of different things, this space. And I think, you know, even if you just take the different products, you know, healthcare insurance, and life insurance and PNC for personal or commercial, to me, those are very different end markets. They have different dynamics. And I think there's big software companies that are being built and continue to be built across all of them. I think the problem with what happened, why it's gone a little bit out of favor with other investors who might be a little less patient, is I think the best things in B2B in insurance really do take a lot of time. Usually you'll see a company get out of the gate with a pilot with one large carrier or reinsurer, or perhaps like mega broker that's excited to have an innovation partner and might pay them a few million bucks a year, which is game changing for a small team, a startup, particularly one that's done it, never done it before, and has just identified the insurance market as their end market for technology. And those things tend to hit a ceiling when they try and replicate that across another 10, $3 million contracts, because that's just hard to do. And if it were easy, you know, the opportunity wouldn't even be there. So I think there's, on the direct-to-consumer and direct-to-business side, it wasn't the fault of the companies or the investors. It was kind of, it was tied to the environment, the zero interest rate environment, why those business models went down a certain path of grow fast at all costs and kind of deal with the consequences later. And on the B2B side, you know, to take an example in my own portfolio, Shift, you know, Shift Technology started just in France, the team coming out of AXA, just in France, just auto insurance, just fraud detection for claims, not claims and underwriting. Today, they're multinational, multi-product. They do both claims and underwriting, but it's been a several year journey, you know, to close seven figure plus contracts, you know, across the incumbents to fight back against the wave of insurtech pressure they felt 7 or 8 years ago. So some of the really good stuff happening in insurance just takes a lot of patience, and that's not for everybody.
So one thing I want to better understand is, so from one side, you're saying the zero interest environment led to a lot of capital, which led to growth at all costs. But at the same time, I do think there's a few fundamental issues with the business model of some of these companies, mainly because my feeling, or my insight, at least I would say, is that just a direct-to-consumer brand that is online is going to have a very hard time with CAC. Fundamentally, I mean, it could grow very slow, but you're still going to have a very inefficient CAC in a sense. And then the bigger issues is that I think the customers you attract tend to be the price shoppers of the market. So not the best type of customers, which means even if, like, because the reason I'm asking is, like, I understand the zero interest environment meant growth at all costs. But the question is, like, if they start again in this environment, would it even be a possibility for another direct, you know, to customer auto insurance brand with no unique advantage apart from, like, you know, just like being like another, I don't know, State Farm, but more efficient? Would that be enough?
Yeah. I mean, I that's just a business that requires, I mean, if you want to go for that strategy and just say, we're going to use technology and be 20, 30% more efficient than Geico or State Farm, you could with a straight face pursue that strategy. You're just going to need a lot of capital to pursue that strategy, right? Even if you're disciplined on every other element other than using more technology to have your expense ratio be more attractive. Like, that would be that pitch. And that pitch is actually kind of credible. It just requires a lot of capital. So that's why I call it, you know, tied to the zero interest rate environment. Because when you're a startup, even though there's a lot of venture firms that are still out there flush with capital, I think everyone's just in the rate adjusted environment, like, more focused on efficiency. I like to think that we were always somewhat disciplined on that fact, which is why we didn't really play that wave of companies. And again, a lot of wealth was created and a lot of great brands were built, and those teams are super talented, but, like, we just sat it out for the most part, because we just didn't think it would end well. And you know, story's still to be written, because those companies have access to a lot of capital and have a brand, and they could turn it into something that's durable now because they got through that hump thanks to the funding environment, right? I don't think you'll see much of that over the next few years get funded, even if things do normalize, because people will remember for a little bit. That being said, you know, I think there was a pitch for each one of them that there was something differentiated due to technology. Whether it was true or not, you know, I think is the question. And I think you see it in the data several years later, that there wasn't much of an insight that led to, you know, that the telematics didn't lead to, you know, magically powerful underwriting, you know, relative to what the incumbents could do with their actuarial history and clout in the market with a, you know, network of agents that are sending them high quality leads. Same on the commercial side with all of the machine learning and data driven underwriting that is kind of just becoming real now. You know, so there just was a lot of promise and a lot of logic behind it, but it just wasn't real. So things scaled while that was kind of being built on the fly. That's what I observed.
And to just add to it, from my observation, I think also a big part of InsurTech was a lot of new entrants of talent, which weren't as familiar with insurance. And there was kind of an attitude of, like, we know better how to do this because we come from tech and the insurance industry is outdated, so it's very inefficient, all that. But I think over time, they realized, as inefficient as insurance is, a lot of things have been optimized over hundreds of years. And there's a reason for some of it. Like, I mean, for me, it was very surprising after a while when I realized how important the role of an agent is compared to what I originally thought, which is B2C makes just so much more sense. But once you go into the dynamics, the people, all that, you see, like, there's a lot of stuff that don't make sense from an outside, but there's a reason why it's been set up like that. And again, it's the result of, like, I think hundreds of years of evolution and, you know, trying to sell to customer and advising them and all that.
Yeah, exactly. So when I made that observation years ago, I said, I'm going to continue to meet with the wildly talented entrepreneurs that are spending the next 10 years of their lives, you know, crazy enough to try and create a new type of insurance company. And I would hear them out. But what we were really, like, looking for was the folks that were, you know, disrupting the IT and software providers to the industry as they were just so far behind other industries we've studied. So, you know, that's starting to happen. You know, companies like Shift and Uncork, which is not in our portfolio, you know, that just have built really interesting software models. You know, the likes of Socotra that are trying to disrupt the legacy players for the core systems that insurance companies run on. You know, that's what I find really interesting right now, because that's a really large prize. Whether you sell to the upstarts or the incumbents, you know, the best companies would probably sell to both. That's what I've observed across financial services.
So that's a good segue. So let's talk more about the core thesis you have around insurance. So what are the specific areas that you're super excited about? You kept repeating and talking about like IT systems and, you know, kind of like moving everyone to more modern infrastructure. Is that the core area or all there? Like, how do you bucket this in terms of like, what are you specifically excited about today?
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting models. I mean, frankly, your company is taking an interesting approach, and many others that are kind of identifying that, you know, the agent's not necessarily going to go away in most elements of the insurance landscape. I think some agents will. We bet that the title agent should go away as one of our core theses, but that's a kind of esoteric product tied to the mortgage industry. But I think for many things, coming back to the wealth management analogy, I think it's quite similar to the RIA world, where you could theoretically manage your money yourself. You would save some basis points here and there by doing so, and not charge, you know, being charged the fee to have somebody to coordinate, somebody to provide you access to ideas and capital deployment strategies, but more importantly, just someone to talk to. I think that's what most people pay for, both with an agent in the insurance world and in the real estate world or wealth management. And I think, you know, whether it's commercial or personal, I think our thesis is that the agents will be powered by technology and not going away. So we've long studied the policy management system landscape, the marketplace concepts that connect the dots between the wholesale community and the agent community and the carriers and the reinsurers. There's so many different elements of that value chain before policies get priced, bound, you know, traded, and in terms of the risk market, and you know, the world's changing pretty fast in terms of what risk looks like because of our changing environment, both environmentally, politically. Like it's never stagnant. So I think the idea of an advisor and an agent is just not going away. So the software that's going to connect the dots on the data side, you know, we've seen a lot of concepts kind of start to get there, but be acquired before they see it all the way through. You know, companies like Bold Penguin or Indio that we've studied over the years to be examples of ones that were acquired, but kind of going down the path of some of the problems I'm discussing. So that's, you know, rambling a little bit in our unscripted combo, but that's kind of some of the things we're really focused on. But it goes all the way down to, you know, just the way payments are handled and finance is handled in insurance. So there's some really interesting companies right now attacking that problem set. So, you know, it's really the guts of how policy admin systems work, agency management systems work, payments of claims, premium finance, like all the nuts and bolts about how insurance actually works. And then eventually, you know, we do spend some time on the reinsurance market, which is pretty esoteric and I think difficult for the typical startup to attack. But, you know, we still think there's a lot of value throughout the B2B insurance software stack. But you got to find a wedge, you got to deliver really hard ROI, you know, to build an interesting business and then expand from there in insurance, because you can't just talk a big game and get all the participants on some sort of marketplace strategy.
So let me ask you a few questions, because I have a few strong theses around insurance that I'm passionate about. And in some cases, I think it makes no sense to anyone else. The number one thing I'm excited about is, from a passion perspective, at least, is I feel like insurance was the idea of us coming together, helping one another. It's a pool model, which I understand most companies are, but at the same time, they're not really, you know, it's just based on that idea. And they technically are structured like that, but it's not like a real true P2P. And I understand it's very difficult, but just like, you know, thinking about it. And the second thing that I'm super excited about is the idea that when insurance started in the 1600s, it was the most basic format of like just pulling people together. And then we had statistics, which allowed us to do a little bit more manageable. But I don't feel like insurance has truly been, has changed. We're all talking about like making it more efficient. I always had like a very soft spot for like the idea of holistic risk management, which I know it's an idea that a lot of people have kicked around, but at the same time, there's been almost like zero progress towards it, to be very frank. I understand that there's been little things, attempts, but because the way that people behave when it comes to risk management, it's kind of been always kicked to the curve as a long-term thing, good to have kind of thing. But I want to see, like, generally speaking, in your idea, like this idea of like a holistic risk management for customers, the idea that I always had like an AI that could just like understand your risk and then as much as possible manage it for you, and then whatever needed to ask for your permission for an action or ask you to do something, in a sense. Does that make any sense to you?
It does. I feel like it's in and I've heard some of these ideas and concepts over the years, you know, just kind of like coming back to your concept of like reinventing, you know, an industry that's, you know, one of the oldest industries known to man, right? And I think there's a reason the industry set up the way it is. Some of that is political and regulatory, but some of that is fundamental, you know, risk sharing and taking. And I think, you know, some of the ideas that have been logical lately are when we change the way we live or work, that requires a new type of insurance, right? I mean, I think, you know, a company like in Europe, like Zego, that started by insuring the drivers who worked for the delivery, the meal delivery companies. Like that was a really interesting concept because that's a new problem space. Like it's not a typical commercial auto policy. It's not a personal line. So how do you create products for that? So I do think there's opportunities for as we live and work differently and the world changes, that insurance needs new products. I've never been convinced that needs to be a net new company. I think, you know, the large, sophisticated risk takers with unbelievably powerful balance sheets should be the ones creating those new products with the help of a B2B startup that's going to provide the data. And that's just more my mentality. You know, I've been wrong from time to time, but like you kind of have to stay disciplined with your thesis sometimes. But you know, I totally agree with you that there's opportunity there. The holistic like insurance for one human or one family, it's a really difficult problem to solve because I think whenever you're talking about that, to come back to the wealth management analogy again, whenever you're talking about risk, there's usually not a right and wrong answer because it's so much about risk tolerance and personal choice and desire. And, you know, I think the reason people go to a broker of insurance or a provider of financial advice is because they know your risk tolerance and then can cater the right answer to what is a fit for you and your family and your desires and your comfort level. Because sometimes overpaying for insurance just will give people happiness in some ways, you know, kind of over insuring, or some people are just you know, can't handle leaving a penny of premium on the table and just want the best deal they can and to have the bare minimum that's required by their local township, right? So I think you can make recommendations with an engine like that. I don't think you can automate it because these things are so personal. I don't think the whole world is just about alpha generation. I think there's so much nuance to what people really want with these personal financial services.
Yeah. So what I describe is more like a very, like, if we were to reinvent it, what would it look like? But a more practical, I think, approach to it would be similar to what you said, which is it doesn't have to always be a net new company, but at the same time, if you could move the current space into more and more closer to a high loss ratio model, like similar to what healthcare tried to do with Obamacare and mm-hmm. so on. Instead of the 40% overhead, you have like 20% overhead or 15% overhead. Or what Lemonade was pitching with like the 20% overhead kind of model. That could be one way. And the second thing is like, it doesn't have to be a single policy. As long as you have someone to liaison all of it for you, it could be multiple policies just with a unified kind of front in a sense. And obviously, when we talk about risk management, it always starts with insurance advice and could then grow into like risk management as a pragmatic view. But generally, I think a lot of things like this would definitely have a lot of behavior change and all that, which is too much of a reinvention and could have a huge impact on people. But I was just thinking from a logical point of view, if we were to reinvent it from scratch again, could it, could that make more sense? But in terms of like how feasible that is, that's a whole different story. It's more bad.
Yeah.
Thinking what can be the-
Yeah. No, logically, I think you're onto something. I mean, when I went deep on the life insurance market, one of the things that kind of baffled me was, you know, most people, and I didn't understand this even myself when I started to have a family, but you know, your insurability is like an asset on your personal balance sheet. And no one ever really describes it to you that way, whether it's the market, whether it's a financial advisor. You essentially, you know, if you really did a balance sheet of your life, like when you're young, healthy, and earning, like that's when you should put a lot of this stuff in place. But it's very, very difficult to do that. It's just like a PFM solution that tells you to buy less Starbucks. That's never fun. So I think that's part of the problem with consumer financial services is even when things are really logical, it's not always easy to sell medicine.
Yeah, no, I that's what I learned because when I had Vero, the previous company, what we learned was that people are kind of wired to buy auto insurance and home insurance and maybe like life insurance. Beyond that, if once it gets out of the wiring system, I would say it becomes very complicated. And it requires a lot of trust. It requires a lot of explanation. It requires, and frankly, even though that agents are probably the most trusted channel for most because it's a personal relationship, a lot of times a family member, it's still, it needs a lot like of massaging and helping to understand. And people generally are not good with like simulating the future, the risk and all that kind of stuff. So it is definitely very difficult to kind of sell special. And that's one of the reasons I'm never a big fan of like new products. I feel like a lot of times when you have a new product, and you expect people to make a logical choice when it comes to insurance, they just generally don't make logical choices. And it's super interesting. So if we are, you know, we spoke a little bit about what you're excited about in some of the specific areas. One area that you kind of briefly spoke about is like new risks and new opportunities for products. Is there any specific products you're excited about? I know there's a huge amount of hype over cyber. There's like so many cyber companies now. Cyber or otherwise, like any areas of risk that you feel like has a big opportunity or potential?
That's the one we've spent the most time on. We have a really long-standing cybersecurity practice, so I've collaborated a lot with my colleagues on that side because insurance carriers and the reinsurance market that has been taking on that risk certainly has not connected the dots with the actual vendors that are cutting edge and thinking two steps ahead in terms of how to evaluate enterprise cyber risk and how to tie that to the insurance industry. So I still think that's an interesting market. A lot of the players that have been well funded, coming back to our prior conversation, have gone pretty actively direct to business and tried to sell directly to the brokers to be another option, you know, in their quiver to offer to the end customer. But I think there's still some interesting opportunities in that space. Obviously, Symantec spun out their business, CyberCube, which has become a meaningful player in the space. But I still think cyber insurance is an interesting market. And obviously, what's happening with climate, you know, and not only the realities of climate change, but the impact on the corporate world, specifically in the U.S. and Europe. But I think that's going to proliferate all over the world, you know, just as it becomes a burning problem. And I think there's going to be interesting new insurance products that are tied to the environmental push that we have to make if we're going to be around in a couple decades.
Makes sense. So let's keep this direction going. So as we think about the future of insurance or future of risk or just the future in general, let's just imagine what insurance would look like. So when it comes to risks, it sounds like there's going to be a lot of areas of risk, like cyber, that are going to be much bigger, and a lot of environmental risk and so on. How do you see distribution? You know, we're very, like, I kind of spoke about the idea of a modern risk advisor. I think our job, our companies really belong on the idea of like converting, transforming the current distribution force into modern risk advisors and getting closer and closer to the idea of like the idealistic vision of like a holistic risk manager, as we may call it, powered by obviously the personal relationships that people have and so on. But what's your distribution? Like, what is the vision that you have in terms of what insurance distribution is going to look like?
That's probably the hardest question to answer. Because I think, you know, a lot of private equity world obviously loves these roll-up plays and has done it in insurance and wealth management and others kind of over and over again. So I think you will see kind of a consolidation of platforms that serve as the brokers for distribution. You know, that's probably private equity driven because it's a really good business. I mean, it's, you know, an agency has a recurring revenue model, stability, you know, all of the things that a private equity investor loves. So I think you're going to see kind of several large platforms that become kind of more household names as opposed to the long tail of players that has existed for a long time. And I think that'll just mean, you know, powerful distribution channels to try new things, but those folks will also just have a lot of power in terms of what, you know, if the economics are questionable, they're probably not going to do it until it's proven. So that's always the hard thing in insurance. It's like, how do you do something new without the actuarial data? And then once you have the actuarial data, usually it becomes somewhat of a commodity and everyone can offer it. And then there's pricing pressure. And you know, if ultimately it becomes an admitted product in the US, you don't even have a choice on how to price it. So it's such a complicated space for true innovation. But I think if there is a need for a product like that, I think there's going to be consolidation both on personal and commercial in terms of the brokers that pump these things out.
What about direct or potentially even embedded? Are you long on these channels?
Embedded is a concept that how can you not be long on, right? Like there's no better model in financial services than not having to acquire the customer. You know, we had a company called Bread, which we sold to Alliance Data Systems that was competing with Affirm and Klarna in the installment loan space and e-commerce. I mean, if you don't have to acquire the consumer, you can be really disciplined on underwriting. You can truly focus on building software and having a really high margin business. So embedded insurance is, there's a lot of really great entrepreneurs that have been trying to crack that for a while. Some have had success in the travel space. Some have had success with, you know, some nuanced products like even pet insurance. I've seen a couple examples, but no one's really cracked, you know, true point of sale moments outside of some examples in the home buying process where you have no choice to close on a mortgage to put the home insurance in place. That's a good POS opportunity. Blend has capitalized on that in their business model over the years. So point of sale is one of the answers to cracking the questions we were talking about earlier is, you know, if you don't have to spend a lot to acquire the customer, you can try things. You can grow in a way that is differentiated. But that's, again, just a B2B enterprise play, really. Masquerading as direct to consumer, because it's not, you got to win over the channel that already has the customer.
Yeah, that makes sense. And to me, I mean, the idea logically makes sense, but I feel like it's a little bit more hyped and people are a little bit more optimistic than they should be about how difficult it is. And the thing it really comes down to is when I look at the volume to conversion ratios for most of these plays has been very low. And I think a big part of it is that 80 to 90% of people you get exposed to on this platform already have a relationship for their insurance somewhere else. And it's very hard to move them. And this is why I always thought transforming where people are today is much more effective than acquiring new relationships from scratch and having to compete with everyone who's looking for those relationships. And in a lot of cases, people with lower LTVs because they're price sensitive. And what do you feel like about like insurance versus insurtechs in terms of the carriers of the future? Like how many of them do you think are going to be the newly established players who have been established recently or are yet to be established versus just incumbents?
I think there'll be very few kind of net new players that that want to, or like should want to, or actually do want to become a full stack carrier. I think there will be some, right? Because there's talented people that are crazy enough to want to go through that journey and can raise capital in that way. And I think there will be some, but I think it's more probably going to come out of the crop of players that got started when the funding environment was a little bit different and capitalize on their balance sheet strength to build a really solid insurance business. I've actually started to notice in some of the data, I'm not going to name specific names, but some companies that raised Series A's and B's in the insurtech world over the past couple of years, like start to adjust and actually show some pretty solid efficiency metrics. Because if you don't focus on growth at all costs and start to use software to run your business more efficiently, like I think there's going to be some pretty good tech-enabled MGAs that get acquired by incumbents and help incumbents become much more tech-enabled over the next few years. So I think there's going to be a lot of M&A activity in the space when these companies aren't desperate to sell. They're going to be cash flow positive and have real gross written premium and get bought for reasonable multiples. I think that's what's going to happen in the space. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs and team members are going to make really good money in those outcomes, but not sure about the venture investors that pay high prices. So that's how I think that'll play out.
Makes sense. And now kicking the gear towards like the short term, because we're speaking about it like in the short term, what are some of the possibilities? Let's talk more about it. So I know with all these new trends around AI, LLMs, and so on, that there's like a lot of hype going on with some of the opportunities. You know, maybe we could start with that, but generally I'd like to kind of get your thoughts on what are the biggest leverages today or the biggest trends that is impacting insurance and creating opportunities that necessarily weren't the case a few years ago.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest one is probably just, you know, it's not to be trite, but you know, there have been some pretty amazing breakthroughs in these large language models over the last year. It's not an overnight story, and a lot of companies have been working on actual AI for a while. And I think companies that actually understand machine learning and artificial intelligence and are already selling to insurance carriers, like the company I work with, Shift Technology, but there's others too that have actually been using modern techniques to help carriers and players in the ecosystem. They're going to leverage the breakthroughs from OpenAI and others to really kind of accelerate the impact. And I think boards of any company, not just insurance, are looking for answers now. And I think you're going to first look to the vendors you're already working with. But I do think there's opportunity for net new company creation that leverage these recent breakthroughs in large language models, apply them very specifically to the highly regulated world of insurance, and build an interesting business. And then the best teams usually take that starting point and build something bigger from there to perhaps disrupt some of the legacy players we talked about earlier that have been kind of embedded as the core systems in insurance software for 30, 40 years in some cases, and are owned by private equity that are investing in the business, but not necessarily at the same pace that a startup funded by crazy people like me would be doing it. So
a few of the use cases of LLMs that I've seen recently really pop up. One area is similar to the company that you guys recently invested in, Sixfold.ai, which is using LLMs for underwriting. Obviously, one of the most popular examples is data ingestion for reading documents, OCRs. Mm-hmm. Fund is very big on that and processing hundreds of pages. We are very big on LLMs for customer support, both in terms of front end as well mm-hmm. as service support. Both in terms mm-hmm. of intelligence of responding to Q&A and consuming vast amount of like insurance knowledge, as well as just responses and generating responses and so on. What are some of the other, anything else like there, or any key areas that you're super excited about, like how the value chain is going to be impacted?
I think, and I've been thinking about this across the entire financial services landscape. I think it creates many, it's scary, but it creates many new vectors for fraud and a lot of new surface areas for fraud, right? I mean, the fact that it's unbelievably easy to seem that you are someone else, whether it's through the written word, voice, the image recognition that is now difficult to match up with what LLMs can and generative AI in general can produce. I think the fraud detection market is really prime for a wave of both problem and opportunity for the vendors that help combat that. And that goes for insurance as well. So I think that's connected, but a big area. And then the reality is you can't really use these things in a highly regulated industry like insurance, unless you have a system of record that's showing people how a decision was made. It can't be a black box. So I think there's just opportunities for vendors. And that's very much what Sixfold is setting out to do, is to kind of be that partner for the industry to leverage these technologies. And they're focused very much on commercial insurance in the beginning, and how they go about leveraging these breakthroughs, but not doing it in a way that's out of compliance.
And last question, because I know we're running out of time, is how do you see like both the investment landscape as well as the insurance landscape in throughout the year and maybe early next year? Do you feel like the market is going to get better, worse, or what are some of your insights?
I don't know, Ali. It's really, really difficult because every market dislocation period in my career has just been really different. And I think this one's playing out very differently than others. Kind of a unique set of circumstances where a lot of great companies were funded. A lot of them have more capital than they need. There's a lot of funds sitting on the sidelines with fully committed capital that they need to deploy. That being said, interest rates have gone up dramatically. And something has to change when the cost of capital goes up. So it's really felt like a period of pretty significant standoff and waiting. That can't go on forever. I think next year we're going to see a lot of financing start to happen. And some of that will be a reset. Some of that will be companies that are just getting going. I mean, there's always new company formation. That's why I love working in venture capital. It never stops regardless of market conditions. But I think for companies in the insurance software world that have been out there for a while and might actually be turning the corner, it's just going to be a question of valuation and what it takes to kind of get to the next level. I think people are going to try and do more with less. Round sizes will get smaller, but there's going to be a lot of financings that happen next year. I think this year has been a period of everyone trying to get as far along as they can without testing the waters.
Yeah. Hell of a time to be a founder, huh? But might be a good time to kind of start building.
It's always hard. It's always hard to be a founder, and it's always a lot harder to do what we do than it looks. But it's not as hard as being a founder. That's fair. That's for sure.
Good. Charles, well, it's always a pleasure talking to you. And obviously, you have very unique insights, very educated on the space, and a lot of interesting opinions. Any last words? Anything that I missed I should have asked you?
No, super, super interesting discussion. And obviously you've seen so many twists and turns in the fact that you've dove 3 feet in and are all in on your own thesis on how the personal lines business is going to change in the next decade. You know, kudos to you and the COVID team.
Thanks, Charles. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. And I hope everyone enjoyed listening to it.